My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be as safe and sane and sober as I like to say. I really hate to waste the time on this, but Bill Wilson has called me from heaven and asked me to do it. So I people around me couldn't hear him, but I could. Last time that happened, they put me away. But he asked me to tell you this little story. About 30 years ago in the San Fernando Valley, there was an old guy named Bill, and he was kind of a crazed guy. Wild Bill, he was known as. And he went to the Sylvan and Cedros meeting, an old meeting out there. And he was kind of fanatic about anonymity. He didn't want anybody, not only outside of AA, but not inside of AA. Don't tell anybody. You know, just don't tell them who you are. And what he would do, when they would read the traditions, he would accent the last phrase so everybody heard it. He'd join in with them and whisper, "Principles before personalities, you hear that?" He'd say, "Oh, for Christ's sake, Bill, shut up. I'm not going to shut up. It needs to be said." And then after a while, about three or four young guys, one of whom I knew, used to join in and mock him just to make him crazy. They'd say, "Principles before personality. Is that right, Bill?" And he'd say, "Shut up, Bill, shut up." And that was all right. Went on for some time. And some guy came over from the Canoga Park meeting and heard this and thought of some sort of spiritual breakthrough and took it back to the Canoga Park meeting. Pretty soon they were saying, "Principles before personality." Yeah. And eventually, there's about four meetings in the valley where they used to say that. People who got there to speak, we all used to laugh, go out to the Greek chorus meeting, the chanters meeting. And that's kind of funny, give you a little break from real AA. And then somehow the cork got out of the bottle, apparently, and the germs got in the wind, and they got blown around enough different places for some time. There's been people who said, "Principles of personalities." They have no idea what they're saying it for. They have no concept. I've asked many of them, "Why are you chanting?" "Because, you know, that's all right, you know, I don't judge." And now they not only they chant at the end of chapter 5 for no reason whatsoever. "God could and would have saw." They'd chant at the end of promises, too, if they knew what they were. I'm not judging. I'm not telling what to do. I noticed here there weren't very many chanters. There's a little block of them right back there. We have photographs of their lips moving. We'll find them. But it has no purpose in AA. All it does is distract from the reading, distract from the newcomer's understanding, as far as I'm concerned. Makes, in fact, many meetings now, the secretaries ask them not to chant because it's just the readers read and so on. In our group, which is, a very large group, 1,100 people every Wednesday night, they read them every week, and there's not even one voice ever because, you know, you want to have a little respect. But all I'm saying is this. I know that some of you are probably set in your ways, probably been sober 7 or 8 months and probably got it. There's no way to do anything about it. But if you're kind of new tonight, and you haven't yet formed any bad habits, just remember, you can chant if you want to, but you're not doing anything for AA or what it means. You're mocking Bill out in the Canoga Park meeting, the Sylvan and Cedros meeting. If that's how you want to be remembered, that's your business. All right. Is that okay, Bill? Okay? I first came down to the Mad Dog days, must be about 20 years ago, when they were over in the old hut over in India, that terrible metal building that just soaked up heat. No decent speakers would come down. They'd get whatever they could get. "Will you come down, Clancy?" "Oh, yes." And I remember that very well because Keith came down with me, and a woman I sponsor had just been jilted by her fiancé and was semi-suicidal. I said, "You come along, ride with us. Go down the Mad Dog days." All right. And he had a baby of his, a guy named Kent, who drove us. Some of you know Kent. He has verbal diarrhea, to put it nicely. We got into the car in West Los Angeles. I said, "How are you going, Kent?" And he finished telling us just as we pulled into India. The woman had a new reason for suicide. was a good trip, incidentally. That show you what the trip did. That woman and her fiancé eventually got together, and they were married, and lived happily for several years. Then he jilted her again. And he has since had a relationship and jilted two more. That's all right. There's nothing wrong with that. Teaches him a lesson. And the woman has become very successful, and she's now in very severe problems with cancer, but she's a dear woman. I talked to her at length today. But anyway, and I thought to myself, guys, I don't have that anymore. I drove down here. I came from work, directly from work. And I thought, we're going to recapture that feeling of just absolute total sound, like a river going in it. So I had dinner with Shirali tonight. We sat down, and I said, how are you doing, Shirali? And as I finished my orange sherbet, we were up to, we're still in her prenatal stage. It's not easy simulating a heart attack, but I did it. I've really recovered now. I got to the nitroglycerin in my room. But I'm happy to be here. I'm glad to hear Donna talk. She said something. It wasn't exactly what she meant, but I had a feeling of togetherness. One of your sponsors said she'd never live to be 38 years sober because she was 70. I'm 70, and I'm 38 years sober. Now, isn't that identification? Is that wonderful? Well, and the other thing that she said that I so cherish, she said she was selfish, controlling, what else? Selfish and controlling and what? Anyway, I want you to know, they told me years ago if I went here long enough, I'd hear my story, and I did. Thank you very much. But I'm glad to be here, and I've been sober a number of years, and I've been active a number of years, and it's been very pleasant for me, but I enjoyed this. I enjoyed reading the theme of this convention, celebrating the gift, because that's a very hard thing. If you don't have the gift, you wonder what the hell they're talking about. If you do have the gift, you wonder how you got it, because it's a very hard gift. I, like many people, spent a number of years slipping. I would have bet my life I would never stay sober in this organization, because the worst years of my life came after I was introduced to AA, and people were helping me, and good people, good men, were helping me and trying to do the best I could. And after year of that, I, like Donna thought about doing, and like her son did, I was a suicide in Texas, was successful suicide, except in my case, a neighbor walked over and saw me with the motor running in my car in my garage and noticed I was dead in the wheel, pulled me out quickly and beat on my chest and breathed in my mouth and wound up going to the state insane asylum as a paranoid schizophrenic. And that was caused because that was one of the great evidences of my life. That terrible, hideous, lethal depression was caused because I had stayed sober too long. And I had stayed sober because my son had died while I'd been out in a drunk, and I felt so bad about it. I was in jail when he died. And I stayed sober in his honor, and I thought, God, if you can't stay sober for your dead son, who can you stay? And I did. I stayed sober, but I didn't know that because of the nature of my illness, which I didn't identify then or for years after. No matter how good your reason for staying sober, it only delays the process. Eventually, it all starts to kick in again, the irritability and the difficulty and the resentments and the feelings of desperation and depression and on until one day you drink or explode. I certainly understand that phrase in the book that talks about there's no alternative to drinking. There's a point in your sobriety when there's no alternative to drinking. You drink or you go mad. And I did that many times, and I always knew that was evidence, the best sort of evidence. I am not really an alcoholic. So I went to AA again and again, intermittently over the years. And I know, at the end of all those years, I did bet my life I'm not an alcoholic. I wasn't drinking out of some bravado or trying to be macho. It was just, I could pretend to be an alcoholic. I did that a lot. to get through jams, pretend to be an alcoholic. I got out of that nut house by eventually pretending to be an alcoholic. And they put in the first alcoholic ward in the state of Texas while I was there. And by that time, I was coming off the electric shock, and I was able to realize I can hustle AAs. I can't hustle very many people. And I got out on that basis. But I can't be an alcoholic because I've been to enough AA meetings to know what an alcoholic is. I'm sure there are people like that here tonight who are struggling. Because everybody knows what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is a person, one of those people when they drink too much, and they get in trouble, and their lives get painful, and their emotions get screwed up. And eventually they get driven to a place like AA, and the AA says sober them up, and they clean up their act, and then their lives take a turn for the better, and they live a little more comfortably after that. And I know that's true, because I went to meetings all over the country and heard that story. Variations of it, different amounts of drinking, different amounts of recovery, different amounts of all these things. But that's basically always it. And that's what alcoholics are. And that's why I always knew I was not really an alcoholic. I could sit in the meetings, and I could talk the talk, and I could try to walk the walk, but the one deterrent that always, I couldn't identify it clearly then. Now, that's one thing if you're kind of new. Speakers always talk kind of knowledgeably as though they know what they were doing back there. And they don't. They're just going like a blindfolded guy running through woods. Just boom, boom. I think I'll try this way for a while. You know, boom. Then later you say, then I realized after hitting the elm tree that I was... But you're just stumbling through it. You have no... I've often thought, I wish... You know, it would have been nice if I could have... If you could have the knowledge it's all going to turn out all right, say, well, it's just about another year and 3 months to my sobriety date. Good. Boy, I'm really going to work. There, you know. But you don't know that. You don't know if you're going to die or go crazy or people are going to put you in jail or what the hell's going to happen to you. But I always knew I wasn't an alcoholic for this reason. Because my problem really isn't alcohol. That's why. And I know that because I drink like alcoholics. And I raise hell like alcoholics sometimes. And I get in trouble like alcoholics. And I go to jail like alcoholics. And I go to hospital like alcoholics. But the one major difference is this. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I say stay sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get so out of whack I can barely stand it. And the longer you try to be good, the worse it gets. And little by little it just gets... I want so much to do this for my children. I want so much to do this for my job. I want so my parents will be proud of me. But the day comes, there's just no alternative. You've got to drink or scream or do something. And I discovered as a boy that drinking is the only thing that immediately relieves that pressure. I sometimes think I would have been insane if I wouldn't have had alcohol sometimes because of the intensity of my emotions. I don't know if the drinking caused the intensity. That's a moot point, chicken or egg, whether the intensity caused the amount of drinking. But I know this, that it is when I stay sober that my life gets painful and my emotions get out of whack. And the time comes when I eventually take some few drinks just to relieve that pressure. And I don't do it because I'm a drinker. I do it because I'm a feeler. And I'm not anywhere near as macho and strong as I'd like to be. And inside of me is a wimp who can't take any more pain. And who can't pretend to even take it anymore. And I have a few drinks, and then I'd swear I'll watch it this time, or I'll take care of it. And then sometimes I drink too much, and then well-meaning people say, oh, you have a drinking problem, you ought to go to AA. And the answer to that, when you have to listen to that sort of thing, you have to say, gee, thanks for the advice. But inside of you, a voice just wants to shriek, but you don't understand. You don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were, for God's sakes. I would give anything if my life were that simple. I wish my life could be overcome, the problems of my life, by the things they have on the wall at these meetings. I'm going to turn my life over to God. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? Try that some morning when you can't pay your rent. God will have you sleeping in the streets by nightfall, you know. Write down all the secrets you've kept from everybody because you know the... And then read them to some blabbermouth. How's it going to help me to have some people know that I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? Let me hesitate to add before the legend of my life gets any longer. That is not a part of my inventory. That is what we call a figure of speech. I never went to Butte, Montana. God, I should watch my tongue, too, because my wife's snitches are in the crowd again tonight every time I talk down here. Here's what he said last night, Charlotte. Well, you did it, man. Then she hits me just like that. Yeah. Then you're going to ask God to make you perfect so you can be like all the people you've always hated, get little thin, little. I don't swear, and I don't chew, and I don't go with girls that do. Make amends to people who've been screwing you for 30 years. Here's $10 for calling the cops on me that time. Sorry for the inconvenience. Then there's some more amends, more meditation. That's a great step for people like me. Just when you get sober a while, meditate for a while. Just have your Luger right there. Then you're going to be allowed to take this gift and share it with some other puke. Let me tell you what I found. I don't want it. I can see it in your eyes, Jim. Yeah. And we joke about it now, but that's almost the way I felt, in a sense, sitting in those meetings. It's just as though, I don't know, it's like going to a place where everybody's winning the lottery except you. They're all around you. Oh, it's just wonderful. I think, that guy, I wouldn't hire him to mow my lawn. Now, I'm an executive downtown. I can make people jump by pressing buttons. How can that dumb son of a bitch be understanding things I don't understand? Or what is it? Is it you have to be simple? Am I too intelligent? Am I too complex? Is that it? But I see a complex, intelligent people staying sober too. Now, what is it? It's almost as though like there's some kind of a game where there's a secret code somewhere, but they're not telling you, you know. Yes, I just, you know, and then there's always, every so often you run across some old fool who's been sober forever, and he says things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. One day I walked through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug. And I did. And I've just never felt so goddamn wonderful. Jesus. I envy you, pal, but I can't take that kind of pain. I really can't. There's no, my mother's uncle was a guy named Leo. And they used to, when I was young and acting badly, they used to sometimes invoke Uncle Leo's experiences to encourage me. Why can't you be like Uncle Leo? I look at Uncle Leo. He used to drink a lot. He got sober apparently about 1924 through fear of his wife, I guess. And he never drank again. And it took me several years to realize he never smiled after that I ever saw. And she was always grabbing shit. Remember that time in 1919 when you ran the Model T in the ditch? And I thought, Jesus, you know, it takes some kind of man to live like that. I can't do that. I can't take that kind of pain. I'm a weakling, and I can't take the pain. And now they're telling me drinking is my problem. I wish it were. Jesus, I wish it were. Because if I tell them what my problem really is, they'll put me away. My problem is I think I'm crazy sometimes. I'm feeling inadequate. I don't feel like I fit in anywhere. And I don't. Sometimes I get successful, but the success, there's never enough success. Because it turns out for people like me who live with lives of inadequacy, much of my acceptance in the world was always based on what you thought of me. And no matter what I did, there's only so long that people tell you how wonderful you are. Then they go on to some other business. That, to me, is rejection. And I'll tell you, I look over my life, the terrible experiences I had, one-to-one relationships. I can look back and see them now, you know. It's a very simple reason. I've talked about it many times. Without being aware of it, Much of my life, I expected people, all I expect of you, if you're going to be my friend, just treat me special all the time. Because if you treat me special, I feel average. If you treat me average, I feel rejected. And there's nobody or no one who's going to treat you special all the time. And eventually you feel, well, they've turned on me too, and you go on to the next one. The next love, or the next drinking companion, or the next friend, or the next job, or the next city, or whatever it might be, these people like I do. And I know that it wasn't my fault. I want someone to love me, who'll say loving me. I want someone to, that I can love, but I want someone to be close to. And the other, I'm close to people, after a while, they turn on me. I look back and think, I don't suppose hardly very many people ever turned on me. They just accepted me and stopped treating me special. But to me, that's turning on me in those days. And so I came to AA from time to time when the drinking was bad. I went to psychoanalysis from time to time when the drinking was bad. I spent several $1,000s in psychoanalysis, got to the root of my problems. That's one of the great, you know, that's always been the great excitement around AA. Get your head examined, you know, find out what's wrong. And I did. I discovered that all sorts of things in psychoanalysis. I discovered I had been psychologically warped by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Yeah. I had been repressed because it was strong. I didn't know that. When I found it out, I was really upset. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. I was raised in this Norwegian Lutheran thing in northern Wisconsin, and boy, it was tough. They were tough. You know, there's an old line, but say it again. In the first place, I don't know how Lutherans mate. I don't know how they have any children, because it's just... Can you imagine the thrill of kissing a pair of blue lips again and again? And for example, Norwegian Lutherans, even if they're married for 30 years, would never make love standing up. Just in the fear that some passerby might think they were dancing. Yeah, it's a tough church. It's a tough church. But I loved it. I mean, because the only alternative we ever saw was Catholics. Now it's worse than that, I'll tell you that. Yeah. At least our minister didn't wear a black dress. But I, you know, that's what I learned in psychoanalysis. Incidentally, I must say, my grandparents came from Norway in 1885. They met here, got married here, but they were both old Norwegians. And I'm just sick with excitement because in about 4 weeks I've been asked to come and speak in Oslo, Norway. And I'm going to pretend that I always was a loyal Lutheran Norwegian. Oh, those American Baptists and all those people. I'm one of the great turncoats and slime bags of all time. We call that fitting in. But I learned that my parents' divorce had terribly warped me. I suppose that's true, because when my parents got divorced, I was about 11 or so. And I had lived in such a protected existence, I had never heard of a divorce. If you can believe that, if you're young today, because nobody got divorced. Nobody in our family ever got divorced. Nobody in our church ever got divorced that I knew of. And they got divorced, and I instinctively, and I look back and think about that, I instinctively did the worst thing you can do. And I'd never even heard of a divorce, but there's something already in my system that's just a little too cute for words. When they got divorced, and both of them feeling kind of guilty and ashamed, but they had reasons for being divorced, I instinctively, without missing a beat, start playing them against each other. Playing my mother against my father. I was an only child, my father against my mother. And I'd go to my grandmother and play her against both of them. And I avoided discipline. I avoided structure. I went through my, I suppose, 12, 13, 14 years. And I was outsmarting everybody. And I went from being a straight-A student to flunking out of high school. I had lost everything. I had outsmarted myself terminally almost. And when I was 15, it was early in the Second World War, it was such a state that I just, one day, told my mother I was going to visit my aunt in Superior, and she packed my little bag and gave me bus fare, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco, lied my age, got on a merchant marine ship and was in the South Pacific before they discovered I was not in Superior, Wisconsin. And on that ship, many things happened to me. You know, one guy gave me a ride all the way from Minneapolis to San Francisco. I'm glad because I was so dumb I can't believe it. I was this small and had a face full of pimples. Some guy pulled up and says, "Where are you going, kid?" I said, "San Francisco." He says, "Good, so am I, hop in." And away we went. And he was in the Navy going back to his ship, and I guess he just picked me up to have a lower companion to keep him awake, you know. But we'd stop at night. There weren't any motels like there are now. There are trailer courts, and we'd go into a trailer court. He'd buy my meals. And I didn't think anything strange about that. I thought that's the way it was. You hitchhiked. You tell them where you're going, and they get you there. You know, what the hell? And I look back now, and it's a strange feeling, because today it seemed like I must be the only kid that was not sexually abused. And it's making me feel rejected, actually. I'm not poo-pooing sexual abuse at all. I know it's a terrible thing. But can you imagine being on a ship with a bunch of hard-bitten guys and not being sexually abused, or being out in the middle of a trailer court with a crazed Navy guy? And well, I've overcome that. Anyway, but on that ship, I learned to swear. I learned to lust effectively. I mean, Norwegian Lutherans don't have much training in sexual matters, so I got it on that ship. I mean, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, at the age of 15, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive and afraid and alone, and I hadn't, I didn't know you could do it with girls. And I learned to swear on that ship, and I learned to smoke, but most importantly on that ship, some guys gave me some whiskey, and I drank it and vomited, and I drank some more and vomited a day later, and this went on for several days. And one day I drank and didn't vomit, and I discovered how to overcome my feelings. I sometimes look at drinking my life, look back now, drinking, didn't be, I became a terrible drunk. Like everything else, I learned to smoke on that ship. I never smoked anybody who smoked, but I smoked on that ship. I puked and smoked and puked. And one day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 45 years. Till I noticed I was going bald. You can see the smokers around here. Look at them. But I was awfully dumb, but I learned a little bit about sailing, and then I got another ship, and later in the war I went in the Navy, and got some structure there, thank God. And at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up in Northern California, and they passed around some tests, and I always been good on tests because I'm a reader. And they came back, I didn't know what the test was for. "You were so proud of me. You had such a high score. Here's the Armed Forces Institute is awarding you a high school diploma." I thought, what the hell is this for, you know? But I look back at my life now, that probably was one of the great turning spots of my life. And I thought about that later. If I hadn't done that, or been too cute to take the test, or just made wrong answers, which I might have done in my perverseness, I'd have had to go back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. They'd want me to start my junior year of high school again. And I wouldn't ever do that because I was much too slick. But instead, I went back to college, started in college in the fall. In fact, last September, I was back in Wisconsin, the university, and we are celebrating the 50th anniversary. The beginning class of 1946. And that was, you know, think, what's the big deal about that? That was the most peculiar class in the history of American education. Not, I think, but all millions of guys that just got out of the service. They all run the GI Bill, and they didn't have jobs. They go to college and make some dough anyway for a while until they learn. So you really got an eclectic bunch of people in college, you know. And you'd sit and go to freshman English class, and there'd be some little 17-year-old girl from Black River Falls, Wisconsin, sitting next to some old Navy chief about 38 years old. "Hey, you put out?" And drinking and raising hell. And went back and saw them all last fall, the ones who are still alive. I was glad to see how old they looked. Made me feel young. But I went to college. I had some success in college. I found something I could do well and won some trophies for the university. And out in the world, I became a sports writer. And I was going to be a teacher, actually teach journalism, but I had some problems my senior year with drinking and a traveling magazine saleswoman who had seduced me. I'd never been touched, hardly. Been touched softly a lot, but not hardly. Anyway. But anyway, I lost my job at Duluth Denfeld High School as a journalism teacher before it started, thank God. I went back there a few years later. I went back about 10 years ago to speak at Duluth. I told the story in a little more detail. It's a sad and tragic story. And I said, you know, I lost my job. And then I lost my job up here. And so because I got drinking worse, I got problems in nut houses and jails. And one finally got sober. And finally, after being sober, going through a very difficult time in sobriety, I finally stayed sober and got working in radio and television and big corporations and became somewhat successful. And I know a lot of people now in movies. I know senators and representatives. And I've been in the White House. I've been, you know, I told these people, I said, just think. If I weren't a drunken son of a bitch, I'd be here teaching school in Duluth. And they didn't laugh, I'll tell you this. Well, who cares? Anyway. And I married this girl who seemed to be very fertile and maybe having a lot of children and starting to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations, and all these years I drank, and drinking was the best friend I ever had. I look back at my life now, and I'll tell you something. I can understand the concept that sometimes people use. They say, your emotions really stop maturing when drinking really begins to work. But I think it's safe to say that my emotions during all these years were very close to being 14 years old. My body was big, and my brain was big, and I could talk and glib and write, now slick and clever, but always at the beck and call of childish emotions. It's just, you know, childish over-emotions, childish infatuations, childish rages, childish angers, childish needs for approval, all the things. And when I drank, it eased that off. And it must happen, I found out later, didn't know then. If I become dependent on drinking, eventually it must control my life, although I don't consider it. But it's like a diabetic becomes controlled by insulin. Isn't that's giving you orders, it's just that there must become times when you must have it or pay a terrible price. And yet, I'm sure like many people in this room, you're new, I'm sure you'll go through it now, knowing that stopping drinking is not the answer for me. I did think it was for a while, and I sat in those AA meetings, and good people read to me out of the book and told me about God. But eventually I stood on the street corner in Los Angeles one morning, cold drizzle, and if an old man were to come up, I'd just been thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And they said, don't come back. And if I stood in that drain, I couldn't believe this was happening, because I'd been down, but I was bounced up, down and up. All of a sudden, I didn't bounce up. And it all went in a remarkably short time. If some old man were to come over to me that morning, as I've often said, and said to me, you know, kid, you're getting down near death. You're down near 100 pounds. You've lost your home. Never have another home probably like those. You've lost your wife and children. You won't see them again. You've lost your career. They once upon a time called you a boy genius because you're such a good writer. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost your clothing somewhere. All you got left is the clothes you got on. They're a little dirty and wet. You're an only child, and your mother is not allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather is so tired of watching you get her emotions and hopes back up and then crush them again. He'd rather have you think you were dead. And all these things, and you've been going to AA off and on all these years, and why don't you just, for God's sakes, go back to AA and do something about it? Shape up! And if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, those of us who have been in desperate situations, which I suppose is all of us, know that when you get in that situation, truth is not a high priority. Is how can I get out of this, whatever it takes? How can I get out of this? But if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have had to say, I appreciate your advice, old guy, but you don't understand, I'm not an alcoholic, not really. And if he said, prove you're not, I couldn't have done that because I wouldn't have had the objectivity to be able to stand back then and examine myself and explain why I wasn't. But I know now, and I've known for a lot of years, because I've learned it eventually myself and watched countless others go through the same thing because of one simple reason. I'm not an alcoholic. But I couldn't put my finger on it then. So I probably would have taken refuge behind the things that frightened imitation macho people like me take refuge behind, which is bluster. Get out of my face! Screw you, son of a bitch! Get away from me! So I wouldn't have been able to say, I wouldn't be able to fashion the words that I know what an alcoholic is, and I'm not that. There's something terribly wrong in me, no question about that. I've known that since I was a kid. And I've spent my life disguising it as best I can. Always trying to find which disguise will fit in this situation. I thought, you know, it's the funny thing. I remember in college taking psychology and learning about defense mechanisms. And think what a silly thing they are that people use, defense mechanisms. And never realizing my whole life was one whole defense mechanism. Because I didn't call it that. I just called it survival. And today, you know, everybody has a defense mechanism because the world would all be living in caves with clubs if people didn't act a little differently than they felt sometimes. But everybody's got, you know, my particular defense mechanism much of the time was a imitation intellectual. You know, be in a discussion with someone and say, I don't suppose you have any idea of what Nietzsche had to say about that, do you? No, I didn't think you did. And there's thousands of defense mechanisms. You get way to the other end, which is looks entirely different, but it's exactly the same. The guy in the black leather jacket says, I got a new Harley, and I'm going to drive it up your ass. You know. But they're all saying the same things. Don't come too close. Don't see that I'm not enough. Just take my image. And that's why it's amazing to think that morning I stood in that street corner and I eventually walked 72 blocks out to an AA club that I'd been asked to leave a week before for being in there drunk and denouncing them. And I was so sick and desperate. I remember I mentioned that once in New York, and a woman said, how could you possibly walk 72 blocks when you were sick and desperate? And I had to explain to her, that's the only time you can. You couldn't do it any other time, I'll tell you that. If you had any alternative at all, you wouldn't do it. But when you're sick and desperate and nobody cares and there's nobody there to prop you up, you do it. And that morning turned out to be my sobriety date. And of all the times I ever got sober, that probably was the least potential of staying sober, of any, because I didn't want to stay sober. The one time I'd stayed sober, I wound up suicidal. There's no reason to stay sober. I had nothing to stay sober for. I was cold and sick and desperate. My life was behind me. I was an old man. I was broken. It was all over. I was 31 years old. And it was all over. I'd done everything, been everywhere, and I'd been something, and now I was nothing. And had no idea that my sobriety was starting. And now, as I said earlier, it's next month or a couple months, it'll be 39 years since I took that walk off the street with no hope whatsoever. And 39 years is a long time. 38 years is a long time. I thought about the other day, that's longer than Bill Wilson ever stayed sober, or Dr. Bob. I have not the slightest clue of ever being anywhere near what those guys are. I'm just saying, today we expect people, a lot of people are staying sober for years. And I look back at my life and I think my sobriety is predicated entirely on AA. This is the only therapy I've had since 1958. You'd have thought I'd had some therapy, you know. I did see a psychiatrist a couple times a week a few years ago, because I was his sponsor. I almost had that son of a bitch straightened out, too, but he moved. But it's an amazing thing, because I knew technically almost as much about AA as 1958 as I know tonight. So I don't suppose there's anybody, I would think, whoever stayed slipping as long as I did, who's now stayed sober as long as I did, who doesn't look back and think, what was different this time? What was different this time? Wouldn't it be nice to know that? Not only so much for my own information, but so I could use that difference to help people who are sent to me, because they still send long-term slippers to me. They come off the buses, and I got two of them where I work now, two guys, one from New Jersey and one from Texas, sitting out here. Wickhead, you're just too sick, you crazy bastard. Go out and see Clancy. But, long-term slippers, I wish I had something to tell them that would really... Because when I was younger and more vivacious, I used to think, I can talk these guys into sobriety. I can give them the message, and they'll be all right. It took me a while to realize I couldn't. I can't. You cannot talk people into sobriety in the program. It'd be nice if you could, but you can't. Not that I know. The analogy I think about that is some years ago, trying to help my grandsons, a couple of my grandsons, to learn to ride a bicycle in our backyard. And there's a driveway out there. And John and Joe, and I put John on the bicycle, and he fell off, and he scratched his arm, and Joe fell off, and they, "I don't want to do this anymore, Grandpa." I said, "Yes, you do. You just don't know it. Get back on it." At the end of our little training session, they couldn't ride a bicycle, and I felt so bad. I felt like an ogre, and they looked at me with concealed hatred. "I'm going to tell Mother not to bring me here anymore." And that's too bad, too, because grandparents and grandchildren should really get along better than anybody. You know, I don't know if you know this. I sometimes share this with people. You seem to be decent people, so I'll share it with you. I wouldn't tell them this in Palm Springs, Cathedral City. But I'll tell you why. You ever wonder why grandparents and grandchildren get along so well together? They share a common enemy. You can think about that for a while. But we tried to get in those kids. I tried to get in those kids later, and they fell off. And yeah, but eventually, those little rats, one day, something happened to each of them, individually, I guess. And they cannot explain how it happened, nor can anybody else. It's happened to most of the people in this room. If you keep trying, one day, out of nowhere, you suddenly get a sense of balance. And you can now ride a bicycle for the rest of your life. And you can ride a motorcycle if you know how to do that. You can do it. But you cannot give that ability to someone for whom you would give your life. And you can't even give them the ability to ride a bicycle. Because everybody's got to get on their own bicycle. And everybody's got to try to steer, fall down, and try it again. Training wheels. And a much more complex method, it's certainly true of alcoholics and finding sobriety in AA. We can be talked to a certain point. We can be put on the seat. We can be told how to steer. We can be told how to move our legs. But sometimes you just fall down, keep falling down. And sometimes people quit even trying. Most people quit trying because they know it can never work for them. And sometimes desperation is one of the greatest helps you have, because desperation may be, "I know it can't work, but I got nothing else to do." But I look back and I wish there were some simple way I could tell the people in this room who are slipping, or people who, remember the phrase I used to hear in church when I was a little boy? It always stuck in my mind. I forgot most of the stuff I learned, but I always liked that phrase. It always seemed to, "Those who are weak and heavy laden." And I felt that feeling a lot, weak and heavy laden. I just, delicious self-pity, and I'm weak and heavy laden. Well, there is something nice about it. Try it some night. You're lying awake at night and can't sleep. I'm weak and heavy laden. Don't have your Luger nearby again. But probably the most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, is that my name is Clancy Emsland, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, if you're kind of new, you might wonder, when did this old boob become an alcoholic? He was an alcoholic when he drank. He wasn't an alcoholic when he got sober. Somewhere now, he's an alcoholic. Was it some kind of a ray of light come out of heaven and... You know, you hear something that happened. I hear people at AA sometimes talk, and they say things like that. It's just, I envy them. You know, it's just, they get a great feeling. But that, nothing like that ever happened to me. I mean, if it would have happened, I didn't pay any attention to it. I suppose the greatest problem that I had between me being an alcoholic is this. But my problem really isn't alcohol. It is when I drink too much. And it is when I'm in trouble, but it's not really my number one problem. How do you overcome that? And much to my surprise, I was desperate enough to hang around with this club for a while. And unfortunately for me, the club was full of AA fanatics. And eventually you do what they do, not because you think it's a good idea, but you just go along with the crowd. Incidentally, if you're new, I wouldn't call them AA fanatics now. I'm very pleased that club was full of AA fanatics. As I say, I wouldn't call them AA fanatics now. Tonight, I'd call them AA winners. That's why they say that if you're new, stick with the winners. Why do you stick with the winners? Because I'll tell you why. People who don't have much going for them, no matter how much they put on the outside, you don't have much going for you, you don't have much sense of self-purpose or self-respect. You have a tendency to blend into your background. You're like a chameleon, emotional chameleon. And if you're around people doing things, you do the things, even though they're stupid, because that's what they're doing. You want to stay around winners, but of course the question is this: who are the winners? Kind of hard to figure out sometimes. You say the old guys, the old ones have been sober the longest. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. I know some old timers in AA that I just say hello to and keep walking, because whatever they had, they don't have it anymore. They're negative, critical, nasty old guys. They're not the way they used to be 20 years ago when they were active in AA. I'll tell you who I construe to be the winners as far as I can determine. They are the people who are currently sitting in the seats of AA meetings and who are currently trying to either learn or continue to take the actions that their sponsors told them to do or that the other people are doing. And you start off by picking up cups and chairs and learn to go over and shake hands with people. You don't want to do it. I don't want to win it. Hi. And doing the things and picking up the chairs and eventually making the coffee and eventually doing the things and eventually trying to help some other new boob, even though you hardly know what the hell you're talking about. I want to tell you about the program. Just don't ask any questions. I don't know much. But little by little, these are the winners. They are the activists. They are the people who are taking the actions of AA. As it turns out, that's how you stay sober. Not with love and prayer and understanding, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's done with action. That's the only thing that differentiates my... When I got sober in 1958 to now, as I said, I know as much about AA then as I do now. But I had never taken the actions because they didn't make sense. This time I took the actions even though they didn't make sense. And eventually he even got a sponsor. And he didn't make sense. But he hurt me. I allowed him to intimidate me. I don't know if I allowed him or not. He just usurped that role. But I must have let him do it because, you know, that's an interesting thought again. In my area, very unfairly, I am known as a dictator-type sponsor. And I'm not, am I, Keith?
No.
It's not easy creating robots out of living human beings. But you know, really in AA it is impossible to be a dictator type sponsor without the absolute approval of the dictatee. Because all the dictatee has to say is screw you, and the dictatorship is over. I've always thought we should have people who come in the night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Do you still have relatives in Akron? But I allowed him to intimidate me, and all I had to say was screw you, and I almost did a couple times, thank God I did, because I think I basically begrudgingly respected him because he saw through my crap. I love people who like me, but I never respected them because they were too easily fooled. I hated him, but I respected him, and he got me to take actions, and eventually over a period of time, I took actions that little by little changed my perception of reality. But as a result of this, I survived long enough to discover the most important single thing I ever learned. I said my problem is not alcohol. You want to know something staggering if you're new? That's what AA says too. It says my problem is not alcohol. If my problem is alcohol, I don't need AA. How does that grab you? You might say, oh, what? You must be crazy. You know, everybody knows the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 5 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered. They don't. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information on what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you, if they be like me, or I presume like you, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later, people of our type, let me say this in passing. You know, when Bill Wilson wrote this book, he really didn't have the advantage of all the data and information that people have with all their information now. He wrote just on almost an inspired book because he had very little knowledge and very little information. Yet that book has changed more lives than any other piece of literature in the last 5,000 years. But he wrote this book, and he, for some of the things he tried to explain,
he knew that there were people who drank alcohol and seemed to be able to stop. And there are other people who had to be withdrawn in the hospital, but they were able to stop. And yet there were people like him and others like him who, even if they were sober, they had a drink again for some reason, as though when they knew it was killing them. So his effort to try to describe this throughout the book, he kept saying, alcoholics of our type. He never defined what that type was, but we all know what he meant. Alcoholics, people for whom drinking and sobriety become equally untenable. But if getting sober the answer, there would be no need. The problem is not alcohol, then what is it? Is this something like Scientology where we have to keep buying new videos and books or tithe our income to the Mormon church or whatever the hell? No. Everybody in this room knows what the problem is, although they may not be aware they know it. The problem is simply something called alcoholism. And you might say, if you're new, alcoholism, same thing. That's ridiculous. Not the same thing. It's tremendously different. I'll guarantee you, if you be an alcoholic of our type, the day will come when your sanity and life will depend on remembering the difference. Which begs the question then, what's the difference? Well, you could talk about that for 2 hours, and I have once. And it was very interesting. Many of the people had to leave early, I guess, but the leader stayed. God, they're pouring out now. If I can put it in one sentence, an alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. However, this strange thing called alcoholism, this strange mind-consuming, bodily-destroying, spiritual, eliminating, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. You see, sobriety eventually always gets worse than the memory of drinking and the relief. If it weren't for that, everybody gets sober. Pour out sober people all over. In fact, it's physically impossible for a body to stay drunk. Medically speaking, we talk about these people, I stayed drunk for 25 years. It is impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 2 straight weeks in a laboratory. The body won't let you do it. The body fights for survival. Your brain may not, but your body does. In fact, when your body is sufficiently toxified through alcohol, it'll set up a series of involuntary psychological reflexes to reduce toxicity by inducing a procedure called reverse peristalsis. We know that in our groups as puking. Very few people ever kneel in front of the old altar in the morning and say your morning prayer. Oh, God. You hardly ever think of it. My body is setting up a series of involuntary cycles. Some mornings when your body is sick enough, it will reject alcohol toxicity from both ends at once. And you are called upon to make a series of split-second decisions. And every answer must be correct. And if you are fortunate, your loved ones wait outside the bathroom door and inspire you with things like, why don't you go over and puke on her floor? The body makes you pass out. That's all passing out is, so that you cannot get a high level enough of alcohol to affect your respiratory system. I mean, it's all mechanical. You always get sober. You may not stay sober, you may not like it. And you may still have alcohol in your system, but you can't stay drunk. The thing that makes alcoholism a fatal disease is that sobriety becomes untenable, and eventually you have to drink. But why would drinking be of any help? Why don't other neurotics drink? Why don't other borderline psychopathic people drink? You can't even get them a drink. Here, have a drink. Oh, no, I'm going through a crisis. Here's another crisis for you, you wimp. You see, I've given so much in life. I've tried to devote my life to AA. I told the guy tonight, I want a Diet Coke. And he brought me a Diet Pepsi. What's the sense of even going on? You should have seen me before I matured. Anyway. But what is it that, why would you drink it? And it turns out that's the other end of the equation. You hear him talking about this so-called allergy of the body, which doesn't really mean much. In fact, the guy that coined the phrase later said, for want of a better word, I called it an allergy of the body. I would also call it an unnatural reaction. We'll call it an unnatural reaction because it's more understandable. Allergies are kind of ethereal, but unnatural reactions. So what is the unnatural reaction? That's what you have to find out. That's how you determine if you're an alcoholic. What is it alcohol does to me that it does not do to non-alcoholics? What does alcohol do to me that it doesn't do to others? I'll tell you something. Nothing. In fact, it does less to me than it does to normal drinkers or social drinkers. I can outdrink any goddamn social drinker that ever lived. And so can you. It doesn't do it. I handle it pretty well. My body gets to handle it pretty well. So what's this thing? And it turns out it's just the other end of the spectrum. I never would have guessed this in a million years. It turns out it's not what it does to you at all. It's what it does for you. It turns out it does something entirely different for me than it does for most people. But I would never know that. I'd have no way to know that. It's like saying strawberries taste different to me than it does to other people. I have no way of knowing that. I have no idea what strawberries taste like to anybody else. They just taste like strawberries. That's all they taste like. And drinking to me is just drinking. You feel this way and you drink. But it turns out drinking doesn't do that to other people. Drinking to me has the ability to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. To almost instantly change my relationship to my environment. I've heard that over the years, but I didn't know what the hell that means. One of the great examples, I haven't thought about this for years. When I was about, 10 or 11 months sober, I'd gotten a little job finally wrapping packages in the back of an advertising agency. And I'd been an advertising agency big shot for a few years, but now I was being persecuted. And I was glad to get the job, really. And I was wrapping packages on Wilshire. And one of our accounts was something we used to send. It's a clothing company. I used to wrap their mats and send them out to the magazine. But one of the accounts also was Kamchatka Vodka. You don't hear much about it anymore, but if you're old in Los Angeles, you remember the billboards they used to have all over. Vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. And every few months they'd change the colors and the designs, but the words would stay the same, and always that big bottle of Kamchatka. And I'd watch these artists do a new board, and I didn't have any front teeth, because they'd been kicked out in Phoenix through a series of misunderstandings. I'd vomited on a guy's bunk in the drunk tank, and he kicked my front teeth out. Thank God I'd been in psychoanalysis, almost instantly able to identify his problem. You're overreacting. You've been trying to make, But I'd learned to carry my lip like this a lot, so people didn't know I didn't have front. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire somewhere. But they were laying out this board, and I thought, I got an idea. I used to have good ideas. I'll give them an idea. So I was carrying my packages out to mail them and went back with this art director and this account executive working on it. They're like a vodka production. I know it's none of my business, not my job. I got an idea. What do you think? I said, how about this? Kamchatka vodka goes boom, better than all vodkas anywhere. And they looked up, the same look I've been getting all my life from people. Just, what the hell is that supposed to mean? Is that supposed to be cute? You know, you got an ugly mouth, you got a stupid mouth. Why don't you go mail your packages? If you don't like it here, go somewhere else where it's up to your standard. God, public embarrassment, humiliation, I can't think of. The art director was small and rather effeminate. I almost took him, not the county, he's a big guy, but, I thought, if I hit this guy, I'll have to explain to my sponsor and he'll curse me. And I'll just... And that night I found my sponsor at a meeting at the club. And, Bob!
Bob!
He said, for Christ's sake, hold it down. Act like a man if you can't be one. Now what? I told him this whole story. I know they, you know, they have to like it. Maybe they're just jealous of it, but they just treat me like a piece of crap. Bob says the same thing all the time. He said, oh, for Christ's sake, shut up! He used to, when he got very upset with me, wave his finger under my nose. That's the only time I really missed my front teeth. I just, ah! I didn't want to give him the pleasure of gumming it. He said, can't you get this through your head? I've been telling you this for a year. They don't know what the hell you're talking about. Kamchatka vodka doesn't go boom to them. To them it goes blah, blah, blah. That's why you're in this meeting and they're not. And yeah, I could have told you that. Yeah, I thought it was kind of stupid. It's really true. It's really true. And it goes right through, you know, go through life. You see examples all the time. I was thinking about, we were talking about this sometimes at Christmas, you know, in Los Angeles they set up these traffic stops to catch drunkards. And it's just forever. And they're not trying to catch people like you and I who know how to handle alcohol and drive. They're trying to catch amateurs who get drunk at Christmas time. People like you and I who know how to drive are getting caught up in it. Oh, come on, move it out there, for Christ's sake. Yes. But alcohol, more technically, alcohol does not alter their perception of reality. It makes them fuzzy and warm and eventually dizzy and sick. And to me, it makes me alive. It makes me a human being. I had no evidence for this. It's only a feeling of mine. But we talk about this craving that comes after you start drinking. There's a case can be made in my head anyway that this craving is really, it's when you're there and you start to feel it sagging and you have to have another drink to hold it. You keep trying to hold that edge and eventually you get drunk. But I mean, you know, the craving is, I got to have another drink because it's starting to go. And give me another drink. It's not a physical craving, it's an emotional thing. Keep me up there. Keep the balloon going. And one time you're drunk, then you know, what's wrong with you? I use alcohol to do that. Eventually, the problem is you become dependent on it after a while, because every time you use alcohol to run away from the conflicts of reality, you not only run away from them, but you leave them untreated. You may have treated them badly before, but now they're getting untreated. And eventually, you have to depend on alcohol to handle it. These emotional, childish emotions. But eventually, drinking becomes a problem if you're dependent on it. So then you got to get sober. And then you realize it wasn't the drinking at all. It's all these goddamn things that are making me crazy. So you got to drink, but then you get in trouble. So you got to get sober. But you can't stay sober, so you got to drink. And you can't keep drinking, so you got to get sober. That's called alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sober people than anywhere in the history of the world, it is estimated that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. When they die, I'm sure saying the same things to one form or another. But I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank to get some relief and got a little out of hand. Nobody really understands that. And never knowing that they are in probably the most common path they'll ever be on. Because I've been sober a lot of years now, and I've been active a lot of years. So I've had the chance to do a lot of things that some of you people haven't had a chance to do yet. And I talk about this sometimes. The last few years I've been asked to come and speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and Belfast, and Amsterdam, and London, and Dublin, and a lot of places, and Australia, and New Zealand, all over Mexico. You know, you'd think you'd find exotic AA in all these places. You don't. Except for the accents, you hear the same things you hear at our meetings. In every part of the world, it seems like AA, in one form or another, is just like it is in my home group. There's a bunch of people who have done the things and taken the steps, who are doing it well and have become the activists and the winners. There's a bunch of people who do not choose to take the actions because they don't make sense and they hang around with their friends and sometimes they slip and sometimes they sneer at the winners.
And then there are the newcomers in the middle, and both these people fight for their souls. They say, do these things. They say, oh, you have to do all that shit. And may kill them sometimes. But it's that way all over. That's why these 12 steps, it turns out, are so effective. They work for all kinds of people all over the world. But they must be done at depth, and sometimes you've got to take actions that just don't seem to make sense. And yet, and the more desperate you are, the better it is to do it. The very time your mind screams out, no, is the time you need it worst. So that's why we have to stay with activists, I think, with other people, because it's like an 8-cylinder engine. AA, it seems to me. Every time there's 4 cylinders going up, there's 4 going down. Well, I'm going to have a bad time. Well, I'm feeling it up. Come on with me. I'm feeling it now. Come on with me. There's no way that can work except it goes 100 miles an hour down this freeway. I have not become a wonderful person. I have not become a spiritual giant. I have not become the type of great man that my sponsors were. But I've stayed sober in the world, and I've lived successfully, and I've gone to work with very few exceptions every day for 38 years or 37 years once I got working. I've been on the same job now for 23 years in a situation where people get burned out in 6 months. And it's not because I'm a wonderful man, I'm not a good man. What I've done is take actions that what AA is about is not to make you wonderful. It's not to give you a lot of information. It's to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To make you feel like there's some reason for your existence, that you're not so afraid all the time, that you're not so lonely, that from time to time you find, in fact, you find yourself fitting in. It comes so slowly. That's why we have to stop and be grateful sometimes. That's why I think celebrating the gift of being driven to do these things. You have to stop and be grateful because it's so easy to take it for granted. To stop and think what a miracle it is. There are people all over the world who trade their ass to be sitting in here sober with the various hope. And they can't. They can't believe it. They wouldn't do it. They don't have the frame of mind. I believe God loves them as much as he loves me. It took me many years in AA to come to believe God loved me, but I finally did. And I think I could believe it because I think he loves me the same as he loves you. This morning when I went to work, some of you know, I got out of my car and I stepped over the bodies of dying men and women from alcoholism to get to my office. And when I left there today to come here, I stepped over a dying woman on the sidewalk. Get to my car. And if there was some, I believe God loves her as much as she loves me. I knew her very well. She's going to be dead. I've talked to her many times. But she knows that there's no hope for her. And I believe God loves her as much as he loves me. It's just that in some way I don't understand. I was allowed to. I hurt bad enough to surrender my mental processes temporarily to intermittently take actions that she will not take. Isn't it ironic to think you die before you hurt bad enough? Doesn't that sound a conflict? She's going to die probably before she feels bad enough. Because I've watched it happen around me for about a long time now. If there was some easy answer, I would have done it. But then I have to remember, when I stood on that sidewalk, that very same patch of sidewalk in 1958, there's no person in the world could have converted me with words. Because I already knew all about it. I had to somehow be driven to little by little take the actions that opened up whatever love there is coming down. And God hasn't made me a wonderful person. He's enabled me to live with my faults and shortcomings and some degrees of ability to at least live in the world and be of some service to God and man much more than I ever would have. I know that when I go back to, I've gone back, my parents are dead now, but I remember just go back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, take my parents to church, that same old Lutheran church. Take my mother to church and sit in that church and think, isn't that amazing? I've come to believe now that God is in that church just like he is in my meeting in West LA. And he loves me and he loves these people. And the sad thing is these people don't seem to know he loves them because they're afraid of him. Thank God I got to AA where I had to take some actions to come to realize what it's about. I'm not here preaching God. I'm here preaching action. Because if you take the actions, eventually what you need will come to you. But if you don't take the actions, all the thinking in the world won't mean a barrel of warm spit. It will mean nothing. That's why they say action is the magic word. And sometimes after you're sober a while, you're so caught up in life that there isn't much time to do much of anything else and you get feeling pretty bad again. Then you read that book and it has another admonition. You've tried prayer, have you? You've tried meditation. You've tried being kind to people. when all else fails, work with another alcoholic, which is the basis of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have time for myself, but I got to work with somebody else. Yes. Because you got to get self-obsessed. That was the word you said you were. I'm self-obsessed. Well, you ought to be ashamed. Self-obsessed mind off of myself. And it's always the same. It's almost oversimple. When I'm thinking about that puke, I'm not thinking about this puke. That's all. So that's why we gather together. What a miracle this weekend is. Good speakers. Good young people speaker. A little old to be a young people speaker to me, but I don't judge them. But going to be nice. Sit out in the pool, get a little warmth tomorrow. Get the chill out of your bones in about 3 seconds. But be with sober people. And remember, what a miracle we all are. For everyone in here, there are 9 or 10 people worse than we are. Maybe 95 people out there in the world, or 20 people like you and me out, who cannot make that connection, who cannot, will not get on that bicycle to give it another try. So be glad you're here. Do what you have to do to stay here, because once you go, it's not a magic trip getting back. All kinds of people who used to be in these rooms who can't get back. They come back physically, but they've lost the sense of balance, and they go out again. And we all know this, old-timers going out till they die. So let's celebrate the gift of sobriety. When I was in Texas, I got right out of that nut house. They moved me to this alcoholic ward. I'd never been to a meeting in that area before, and they do it differently in Texas. You know, they say things. Now here we get up and say, "My name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic." "Hi, Fred." Down there, it's just terrible. You know, "My name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it's not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind sedating or tranquilizing medication since my sobriety day. And for this, I'm truly grateful." And they say, "Oh, Fred." Yeah. Now, that may be all right for most people when you're just coming off shock treatments, you know. Now, I thought if I could get in the position of power where I stood at the podium and people had to listen to me, I'd give them a straight shot. I wouldn't give them that kind of some recitation like that. I would tell them the truth. So to you goofs who are new back there, chanting, I don't judge you, I'm just reporting. But anyone here who might be weak and heavy laden, let me tell you the real facts of life as I found them in these 38 years and 10 months in alcohol. My name is Clancy Emslin, and I am an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications since October the 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.